From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Once it was Johnny Carson, Leno, Letterman, a handful of late-night big names on the networks, and another handful on stage. Now the channels have broken wide open on cable, on podcast. We've got new names, Eric Andre, W. Kamau Bell, Maria Bamford, Julie Klausner, Comedy Bang Bang. Key and Peele, they're taking more risks and aiming more narrowly for their audience, for your funny bone. This hour on Point, the widening world of American comedy. Emily Nussbaum is with us, television critic for The New Yorker. Her most recent report is Small Wonders, Comedy Off the Radar, looking at the exploding world of niche comedy on cable and the internet. You can link to her article at our website, onpointradio.org. Emily, welcome to On Point. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
You know this world inside and out, and you've given us a pretty cool tour. Many people may be well settled on this new frontier already, but you're laying it open for us. What's happening with comedy, with American humor?
Well, I just find this an extremely exciting time for comedy. On television and online, there are all sorts of new forms opening out, and this is just giving the opportunity for a variety of comedians from different backgrounds with different styles to do radical, experimental, strange, sometimes off-putting work in a way that is somewhat dependent upon the fact that the platform is out there for them to speak directly to the people who find them funny. This is exciting for me because I'm into comedy enough that even though you said that I'm an expert on this scene, I'm in no way an expert on this scene because as much as I love comedy, I simply don't have enough time to listen to all the great podcasts, to see all the YouTube videos, and to watch everything across television. That's how much there is out there.
I mean, that's funny in itself. There was a time when you could pretty much keep up, not with every stand-up in the country, forget it, but with the people who had media access, you could pretty much keep up with what they were up to. I mean, we'll look at all the different exploding tentacles here, but structurally, what's happening? Explain it to us, Emily.
Well, structurally, one of the things that I was noticing in this particular piece was that a lot of the old styles of comedy reaching an audience, which were basically late night talk shows and shows like Saturday Night Live, are, to me, very curdled forms structurally. It's not like there's never anything funny on there, but everyone knows how those things work.
Oh, I mean, to the point where you can sometimes almost not bear to listen because it's so predictable.
It is extremely predictable. And the other thing is people don't even receive those things the same way because when you're online, often you get the best skit on Saturday Night Live or the one element that happened on a late night talk show will just go streaming out virally and you get that. So the best bits get taken out of context of the shows. But the shows themselves just structurally, to me, are kind of a dead form creatively. But meanwhile, there's this wide variety of cable networks, all of which are taking their own they have their own brands, they have their own styles, and they're giving opportunities to comics to present shows that do very, very different things. And the real appeal of this is that these shows can be done low budget without a huge expectation of ratings. Yep. And one of the most notable ones that people have talked about a lot is Louie on FX, which is just a situation in which one brilliant guy was given a small amount of money and told that he could make anything that he wanted in terms of a sitcom. And he created a very experimental sitcom. But Louie, which has gotten a lot of press, and I've written about Louie as well, is just one of many creators out there who are doing interesting things on cable television.
Louis C.K. right there. I mean, let's hear a little example of this. One of the things you're pointing us toward is that when it was all big network late night shows, or for that matter, you know, big stand-up guys back in the day, they had to have big, big numbers. That meant comedy that appealed to everybody, that looked for that sort of biggest audience they could find, and that's no longer necessary in the content of a joke or even in the attitude of who delivers it. We're going to hear in this hour from Maria Bamford, wonderful Maria Bamford from L.A., and W. Kamau Bell will be with us. He's got Totally Biased with W. Kamau Bell. And, of course, cable. He finds a lot of humor in racially charged issues, but he does it from his own perspective as an African-American. Here he is extending a warning to his viewers about wishing black people a happy Kwanzaa.
That's right. If you know any black people, if you have a black friend at work, if you see a black guy in the street, do not wish that black person happy Kwanzaa. No matter how tempting guys like this make it seem.
Some of you may not know that today is the first day of Kwanzaa.
Why, yes, Kwanzaa. Hope that makes up for us introducing crack into the ghetto. Ah, stop it.
Totally Biased with W. Kamau Bell on FX. You are not going to hear that humor from the lips of Jay Leno, Emily.
Well, you won't. You know, it's interesting listening to that because I was thinking it's not as though Kamau Bell, who I love and I love his show, is the only black comedian who's done black-centered stuff on television. Mm-hmm. And there's been, you know, there was In Living Color and a whole lot of different things. The thing I love about Kamau Bell is that when he delivers a routine like that, yeah. he absolutely assumes that the audience is in his circle, like, you know, that people – he doesn't have to over-explain jokes. Mm-hmm. And he can kind – he just has free range on the show to do things in a relaxed, smart, sophisticated kind of way and just talk about subjects in a way where he just doesn't have to lay them out step by step. And it's true that you wouldn't see that kind of thing on late night television. It's interesting to me because I feel like the show itself is – very much driven by Kamau Bell's personality and the way he operates on the show is he just is jocular and funny and he brings pretty much everybody in. It's very refreshing to see. And I think this is a charged subject to talk about, but I personally have been driven crazy by every time there's one of these late night wars things and it ends up being a big media story. People literally present only white guys as possibilities for late night shows.
I mean, every time there's a succession battle going on. Absolutely. I don't remember. I mean, since Arsenio Hall, that was it, right?
I mean, with all due respect to Jimmy Fallon, whose show I think is funny, there was this sense that I just almost had like an internal tantrum about it when that was going on because it seemed so crazy to me that it was just a given that you just had to have a white guy on a continuum of styles in that role and that that role was very important and had all sorts of status because he would be able to reach the widest possible audience. Something very freeing about watching the show on FX simply because I feel like that ratings pressure is off and the show can simply be what it is. And there doesn't have to be this big, annoying conversation about, like, is everybody into Kamau Bell? Can he speak to white people or something like that? Which is very boring.
Go and find him if you like him and that'll be good enough, let alone getting into the world of podcasts where there are so many flavors. We're going to talk with the wonderful Maria Bamford in a few minutes here. But here's a little bit. Comedy often highlights her own emotional instability. Here she's impersonating late night radio host Delilah in her callers, Maria Bamford.
Love songs with Delilah. Where are you calling from tonight? What are your requests and dedications? What's your name? Where are you calling from? Hi, Amy, calling in from Tustin, Arizona. What's going on with you tonight, Amy? So you and Matt broke up. That's hard. That's tough. What do you want to say to Matt tonight?
Never mind color. We're into gender here. Maria Bamford, she had the Maria Bamford Show, now the special, and just having some fun with how crazy some of those listener requests in that whole vein gets, Emily.
But also, I love Maria Bamford. And the way that she does these other voices is very hard to describe. I mean, it's one of those things where when you try to analyze humor and why something is funny, it's difficult. There are distinct things that she does, and one of them is that she really embodies these sort of like vapid or smug female voices, male voices. Like she really goes all across the spectrum in terms of her imitations, but it's a little hard to describe exactly why it is that that worked. But the great thing with Maria Bamford is I'd never heard of her, and I actually came across her because I was obsessed with Marc Maron's comedy podcast. And he has had her on several times. And through that, I went on to YouTube and I saw this YouTube series that she did that I, because I'm a lunatic and a sucker, took for granted that it was what it looked like, which is that she had had a nervous breakdown and was at home in the Midwest with her family and filming it out of her bedroom, which is actually just the conceit of the show and not actually what was going on.
Okay.
But
in the YouTube age, one could believe that.
I'm a credulous online viewer.
Yeah.
But in any case, it was brilliant. Like I just remember watching it in my bedroom and just being like, my God. And it was just this YouTube series done very low tech that captured something about loneliness and mental instability and femininity. There's this routine she does where she does kind of a parody of the sort of, am I right, ladies, kind of female comedy. And there were just other parts of it that are, again, you know, difficult to describe, strange, pungent, perverse, melancholy, odd styles of humor. And now she's done this new show, which is very strange, and I know not everybody will find funny, but I found very powerful and funny, and she's distributing it online. And she's doing that new model where you film a show, put it out, speak directly to your audience, and have them pay for it directly, cutting out the middleman.
Which is working for some people. I mean, was it Louis C.K. who got $1 million for one of his efforts on those lines?
Yeah, Louis's in a unique position, I feel like, in this way. I mean, I think it's a great economic model, and I'm not the person to judge whether an economic model could work because I'm not in that part of the business. It was pretty notable that people just paid up immediately and he made a ton of money. I think that he's a very like a very high profile comedian who has a lot of extremely passionate fans, and that's probably harder for people who are less well known. But there is this thing that happens online where people can help their friends out by letting people know that there's good small stuff out there. And I don't know how Maria Bamford's show is doing economically, but it's a very powerful little show that is essentially filmed in her living room, and the only two people in the audience are her parents.
We'll talk with Maria Bamford in a minute. Here's a little bit from the video from the web series Drunk History on funnyordie.com. Comedian Jen Kirkman gives a wandering retelling of the epic meeting between Abraham Lincoln and Frederick Douglass. The catch, she's just had a few too many glasses of wine.
He was asking Frederick Douglass, what do I do about slavery? What do I do about the black population? And Frederick Douglass comes over to him. He's like, Abraham Lincoln, I am Frederick Douglass. I am a former slave who... And he's like, shh, I get it. I know. I know who you are. It's been explained to me. I've been following your career forever. Be quiet. I'm into it. Like, let's talk.
Abraham Lincoln and Frederick Douglass via Jen Kirkland on Funny or Die. Here's a little bit from the Eric Andre Show, late night talk show on Cartoon Network's Adult Swim. Features host Eric Andre and co-host Hannibal Buress making fun of traditional late night talk shows. Andre sits behind a desk eating a slice of pizza. Buress opens the show's monologue.
Woody Allen is in the news, huh? Well, he's not, but I think his whole existence is weird. Midnight in Paris, good. Marrying your stepdaughter, bad. Are we just cool with that? We cool with what he's living with? I'm not. Boom! Really topical humor.
And here's a little more W. Kamau Bell on his show Totally Biased with, poking fun at classic late night interview again, reaches out to drivers stuck in long lines for gas after Hurricane Sandy. Here he speaks to a driver who's run out of gas while waiting in line.
Now, are you worried about the fact that those people behind you are going to be wondering why you're not moving?
Nah, the cops said they're going to help me push it.
When a black man gets pushed by the cops, that's a good day.
Yeah, well, it depends on how you're being pushed.
So you've got a black host talking with a black man about being pushed by the cops, Emily, and we're in not entirely new, but fun new territory.
Well, you know, it's interesting that you said that it's sort of playing with the conventions of talk shows. I do think that Kamau Bell is in that section doing something new. But on the other hand, it really is just a great man on the street section that he does. He's just very good at it, and he's better at it than a lot of late night hosts that I've seen.
Well, you say
there's
not
definitely
like Jay
subject
Leno.
Matter.
When Jay Leno does it, it's about Jay Leno. With Kamau Bell, it's about the people he's talking with.
You know, that's true. I don't want to spend my time slamming Jay Leno because he's such a punching bag for people in comedy. He ends up being the symbol of all these things. And he's had a very complicated, long career. But it is true that a lot of the shows that I like the most do things that make fun of the kind of lamer conventions of late-night television. But actually, that's part of a long history of TV comedy. All, from my mind, like the edgiest, most – edgiest is a terrible word – but like the most provocative and – intriguing TV comedy has always taken aim at television. That goes from Monty Python, which made fun of the BBC, to 30 Rock, which is making fun of NBC. And Eric Andre's show, I love because it's this strange, shaggy, off-the-beaten-track version of a talk show, and it really does make you aware of all of the banalities of late-night talk shows and just the way that people talk to guests. And he's just an interesting figure on the show. And in the same way that Kamau Bell on his show has his own style, he's warm and welcoming and it makes it feel like a really good party. Eric Andre is strange, chaotic, and vaguely threatening. And I love the fact that there is a place on cable television for both of those things and that there's even more space in a way online, which is where I feel like a lot of the new comic forms are going to come from in the future and are already there to some extent right now. But it's just one of those – shifting kind of structures where eventually I imagine that there'll be a lot of very strange comedy online and all sorts of different ways for people to find it.
I think we're getting out there a bit already. Our podcast nation is all over it. I mean, people writing into us here on Facebook, Sterling says, best comedy heard lately coming from podcasts, Dana Gould, Bill Burr, The Bugle, Andy Zaltzman, and John Oliver, Judge John Hodgman, Jay Moore, all putting out content for free with only requests for donations or sponsorship relations. It's a yuck yuck bonanza. And Alicia says, Louis C.K., miserable, broken, middle-aged man. He's my spirit animal, I swear. I mean, people are finding what they want for their funny bone, Emily.
I think that's true. And I think podcasts are fascinating. I also think that, you know, you played something from Funny or Die, and I talk about Onion News Network in there. And the whole fact that you can do video comedy online and you can do it at any length, there's no set idea of how long a skit has to last or whether something can be a mini series, whether there are other forms of comedy that don't involve video that are just using a GIF. Twitter is filled with what are essentially comedy experiments where people do different personas. So I follow like Honest Toddler and Tween Hobo, who are both excellent Twitter feeds. And then there are other ones that are kind of satires of television shows. Like there's a series of feeds based on the characters for Studio 60. Those are new forms of comedy. And I think that in the future, just because there's so much space to play with the formats, we'll be seeing more of that.
I mean, some of it's new and some's not. 140 characters. Tween Hobo writes, my mother says Twitter is interfering with my studies more than train hopping. Bada boom. But also, here's another from Tween Hobo. My life plan is to marry Justin Bieber. But if that doesn't work, I call my backup husband Justin Case. You know, I mean, it's new, but it's old.
You know, although, you know, those definitely out of context, those just seem kind of like, you know, gags. But the thing with Twitter feeds and, you know, they vary widely. Yeah. But there's this sense of persona that builds throughout them. And it's always the difficult thing about describing Twitter is that it's not really about one particular joke, but about the feeling of a personality throughout it. There was an entire point at which the person doing the Studio 60 one literally did like 48 hours of all of the characters talking to one another and doing some alternate universe version of the show. It's a little hard to get across why that was funny, but I was like enraptured by it. Like I just could not stop hitting refresh.
Hey, we've got Maria Bamford. Here's a little bit from her Maria Bamford show 2009. We'll go straight to her. Here she is in this skit. She's returning home to Minnesota as she plays it. After failing to make it in the LA comedy scene, features Bamford as all the characters, runs into her arch enemy from high school, Christy, also voiced by Maria Bamford.
Hey, Christy, congratulations. I mean, it's like 10 years too late, but I heard you and Todd got married. That's great.
We're divorced.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
So we saw you on TV or whatever.
Oh, that's so cool that you guys watch on TV.
It's just like in high school. It's like you're not funny. You're just weird.
Well, comedy's subjective, you know.
So are you gay? Because I heard a lot of women comedians are gay.
Comedy subjective, you know, Maria Bamford show right there. Maria Bamford joins us right now from Los Angeles, comedian, creator, and star of the Maria Bamford Show and her newest comedy special called The Special, Special, Special. Maria Bamford, it's terrific to have you with us. Thank you very much for spending a few minutes with us.
Thank you so much, Tom. Thank you very much for having me, and thank you, Emily, for writing about niche comedy.
We love that your voice is out there. It's awesome. Do you feel a different kind of freedom, do you think, from comedians who came before you because of the new ways to get out, Maria?
I'm so grateful that there is so much more accessibility. And I think, I mean, a lot of comedians who are younger than I am are much more savvy about putting things out there right away, and because it's kind of like an ongoing world open mic on the video, videos where, and it's so empowering because I know before I would do there'd be showcases and you know they get feedback of like they're just not interested, and now I can be interested in my own work and just go I choose myself. I think I'm great, and I make my own YouTube channel or whatever it is. But it isn't for everybody. And
does it feel lonely, Maria, or do you feel embraced? I mean, when you just put it out on a podcast, is it lonely?
You know, I find it. I would rather be in a place where I feel sort of comfortable. Like the idea where Emily was talking about Kamau's audience, how it seems like they're all on board with what he's saying. Like, that is a great feeling to be, I mean,
yeah.
It's called preaching to the choir. But there is that element, whereas I have, you know, done some late night talk shows or done, you know, been on sitcoms or something and not really felt like I totally belong. So it's wonderful to be able to make your own party, your own workplace. And and the internet has been so helpful with that, because it does all the web shows and podcasts and things, that does make it so that I have very well attended live shows.
Yeah, sure.
So everything it's really it's wonderful.
I want to ask both of you, and Emily, Maria, Emily. Maybe you've met, but meet now,
no.
Please.
Hello.
Hi. Let me ask both of you about. I mean, Chris Rock was talking with Vanity Fair and their big, comedians issue. And they asked him if comedians are better now. And Chris Rock, of course, he likes to go off, and it's funny, but he went off in a big way. And he says, you know, not just no, but, ooh, emphatically no. And he says, show me one guy or woman as funny as Rodney Dangerfield or as good as George Carlin, Richard Pryor, Bill Cosby, Joan Rivers. Chris Rock says, Maria, Emily, he says, what we have now is black comics that work only black crowds, gay comics that do only gay crowds, southern comics that only work down south. He says the previous generations of comics were better, Chris Rock says, because they had to make everybody laugh. Richard Pryor could do the Ed Sullivan Show and play the Apollo. Seinfeld can work any crowd. Ellen DeGeneres can work any crowd. And a few more, but the rest of them are just situational comics. Maria Bamford, what do you say to Chris Rock?
Oh, I think that's a fair point. In a lot of ways very true for me, that there's some crowds that I don't do well in front of.
Does it matter? Is comedy need to be universal? Is niche cooler?
Well, I think it depends on what you're looking for. I think there are people who are more universal, and then some people don't enjoy that. You know, like, if you think about music, you know, it's almost like as soon as the band becomes big,
yeah.
Everyone's like, I was on it from the beginning. You know, like, Dane Cook was given a hard time, I think, by fellow comedians, because he was doing large, sold-out, you know, Madison Square Garden. And I don't have, because it's a little biased. I am totally biased on my end. Cause I go,
go for it.
I think I'm very talented. but I think that is very true, that I will bomb terribly in front of any number of crowds in the Los Angeles area. But if I go to the right place, which is mostly hipsters, I'll do real well. I don't know what to do about it, but...
Does it make Maria and her gang, you know, lesser comedians, or
This is the main thing. I completely understand what Chris Rock is saying when he says that, but the problem is he's setting it up as an either-or, that one is funnier than the other, that the sort of road mentality where you basically break down any audience and make them laugh at any cost is superior to anything else that has a smaller audience. And I just think there are different kinds of comedy. And in the words of the fictional Maria Bamford before, comedy is subjective. And I think that the idea that kind of macho universalism is the top style of comedy and that's the only value that someone can have, it's just going to neglect all sorts of comedy that's genuinely funny and does challenging things. It was actually interesting to me that Chris Rock said that, because he's so close with Louis. And it's clear to me that although Louis is a very popular stand-up comedian, the show Louis is never going to appeal to everybody, and it's sort of part of the point of the show. And this is true for lots of things, ranging from Key and Peele to Portlandia to, you know, stuff I loved when I was younger, SCTV and stuff like that, was never the exact big hit. So my approach to this is not that Chris Rock is not talking about a genuine skill or something that potentially has been lost, but it's not the only way to value comedy. And that if you only value that kind of comedy, you lose a tremendous amount. And you basically, you basically set up a world in which there's this hierarchy that I don't think really matches with what's funny and interesting.
Maria Bamford, you rock to be with us. Tell our listeners how they can get into your latest, the special. Where do they find it? How?
Well, you can either go to my website, mariabamford.com, or you can go to directly to chill.com, where you can, under Maria Bamford, can download my special. And it is with my parents as my audience. And I got to say, I destroy. I do pretty well in front of them. And
they totally agree. Right.
Yeah.
Maria Bamford killing, destroying with her parents as the audience. Hey, listen, thank you so much for being with us from L.A. today, Maria. Thanks.
Thanks a lot for having me. And thanks again, Emily, for writing about the scene. Thanks so much.
Awesome. Here's a little more Maria Bamford sharing her concern for the health of TV personality and chef Paula Deen.
I'm very concerned about celebrity chef Paula Deen because her recipes are like a suicide note.
Y'all, we're going to be making some sweet dreams of little balls of butter, shouting in Crisco, fat back cracklings, blubber, suet, margarine, mayonnaise.
Paula Deen and her recipes like suicide notes, and she just cuts loose. Bill in New Haven, Connecticut, thanks for calling, Bill. We just got a minute, but let me squeeze you in right here. What do you think?
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to know if your
Emily.
Authorities there. I came across a really interesting young man. His name is Graham Elwood, and he does stand-up, and he has a podcast. And his theme is he tends to make fun of karate instructors, and he has a routine where he talks about the palm strike, and he does a quick positioning.
Yeah.
And he's done quite well. I think he did a marijuana tour when states, Rhode Island and all those did their legalized marijuana. So he and his buddy went around the country to those states that legalized marijuana.
Got it. Graham Elwood with a marijuana state tour and humor on the karate palm strike. I mean, it's an interesting test. Have you ever heard of him? Do you
Never
know him well?
Him. Although, actually, I vaguely remember reading about a marijuana tour, so maybe I have heard of him. I'm not sure whether there's two people doing marijuana tours and they're just coming up against one another and there's a big showdown. But
maybe. Throwing down in the marijuana states. I mean, we are in this age when there are options and voices all over the place. Emily Nussbaum writes about them in The New Yorker in her latest piece there. When we come back, W. Kamau Bell joins us, host of Totally Biased with W. Kamau Bell. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the new breed of late-night cable and internet comedy changing the world of American humor, from Comedy Bang Bang to Totally Biased with W. Kamau Bell to Nerdist and a whole lot more. I was tweaking Tween Hobo earlier, Emily, but she's got good stuff, too. She tweets, "So the rich got richer in 2012, and I'm so broke I had to put my retainer in hock." Okay, that's not bad for Tween humor. Lots of people writing to us online here. Allison says, "W. Kamau Bell is the new Jon Stewart, and I love awkward black girl, low-budget, web-only short sitcom. They both offer something no one else does." Ron says, "Key and Peele make me laugh." Stefan says, "The best on Twitter is the fake Jill Biden. Hilarious." Kara writes, "Great topic. Seeing Louis C.K. tonight in Boston, I'm thrilled with the grittier, weirder, and more absurd comedy getting attention." Here's a little of that Key and Peele on Comedy Central. It's a Jordan Peele and Keegan-Michael Key retooling the traditional late-night form to fit their conversational impressions and comedy. Here they show what President Obama, played by Peele, is really saying with the help of his anger translator, Luther, played by Key.
Good evening, my fellow Americans. With me, as always, is my anger translator, Luther.
Hi.
Now, like many of you, I recently saw the video of my opponent addressing his donors.
Woo! Oh, no, Mitt. You know what? You probably wouldn't have liked the White House anyway. There's no elevators for your cars, man. They're going to have to take the stairs or whatever.
anger translator. That laughter outburst, Emily, I don't think we're going to get that on,
yeah,
on the...
But you know something, it's interesting that you guys chose that. I understand why people find the anger translator funny. And those skits are good, and I understand the concept of it. But I'd actually only heard of Key and Peele because of seeing Anger Translator online. I didn't really know the extent of their show until I took a closer look. Mm-hmm. And I have to say, I find a lot of the other stuff that they do that it just... sort of thrilled me in a way that the anger translator felt like a more familiar concept to me. And
I wish I had a bit of it. Tell us, like what?
Well, as an example, there was a skit in which it was basically a bully picking on this kid who was this extremely bizarrely self-knowing bully who was describing all his motives. Yeah. It's hard to describe why something's funny. But there was another skit that was about an extremely fat guy trying to order a bunch of pizzas and pretending it was for a group at a party, but it was actually just him and his action figures, okay. Which sounds like a gimmicky idea. But it turned into something that felt like this really weird, deep, short story about this strange character. And I find a lot of what they do very exciting in that way. And it's funny about the way that comedy works now, because often you get the sort of the most straightforward version of what they're doing online, and then you have to kind of seek it out and see the broader space.
To get the real richness of these niche veins. Jean-Marc in Nashville, Tennessee. Jean-Marc, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, what do you think?
Well, first, going to a previous comment from one of your listeners, I still believe, maintain that Jon Stewart is still the new Jon Stewart. And in addition, though, I also thought I'd never live to lament Chris Rock pining for the good old days. I thought Emily made a really great observation on Chris Rock's comments just before the break. And I really think that I see this as kind of like the next step in the evolution of our social of our civilization, in the sense that, you know, there's many big important stages in social media. First one being, you know, Gutenberg and his ability to kind of make the printing press and give something to everybody. And TV was kind of that way as well, where it's kind of comedy, and in this case, going from the one to the many.
Yeah.
And social media and the internet have really allowed us to kind of get from the many to the many, which has really opened up the doors of so much that's available. And I just kind of think of that, and also in terms of, you know, how many of these comedians that Chris Rock might have been referring to might have put jokes on the shelves because they didn't think that that they cast to a wide enough audience.
Wow, from Gutenberg to Chris Rock to Kamau Bell. I mean, is it better though, Jean-Marc? Do we get the same healing bond when it's targeted?
Well, a couple of things. One of the main things that I think that it really changes is it just kind of changes the water cooler conversation. And instead of coming into the water cooler in the morning, everybody saying, "Hey, did you see that?" "Yes, I did." Now it's, "Oh, look at what I found, and look what I found." And since everything's up there, you don't need to cast to a wider audience. You know, everybody just has the opportunity to get all of their thoughts and experiences out there, and people can find whatever it is that's, you know, their particular niche.
And not left on the outside looking in. I mean, I think a lot of it is better, Emily, because it's real for people's, not some, you know, made-up television national reality that we may or may not actually share, but real for what people are actually experiencing, which is always more universal than you might think.
Also, it's just a matter of just there's a wider variety of it. So, you know, people can come from different POV, and it doesn't have to be the dominant thing. You know, it is interesting because one of the things I was trying to get across in this column is that when you try to beat the drum for a particular kind of comedy, it ends up feeling like this demanding thing, like you're saying, you find this funny. Everybody should find this funny.
Yeah.
And that actually is a kind of pressure that a lot of comedy just doesn't bear up under. But I would agree, by the way, with what the caller just said about Jon Stewart, because I didn't talk about Jon Stewart in this piece. People have talked about him enough.
Sure.
But he really did transform what TV is doing in terms of comedy in some great ways that have a huge ripple effect.
And they just ripple on. W. Kamau Bell is going to join us in about 5 seconds. He's got a friendly, sort of nerdy style, sets interviews on his show apart. People really like it. Here he is sitting down. This is one of those moments, be what you are. He's sitting down with comedian Wanda Sykes to talk about, to African Americans, talking about their wives.
Well, now it's all beautiful. It's just all beautiful.
The lines are clear.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And plus, you know, hey, I got a white woman, so you know, my life is good,
me
man.
Too.
Yeah, hey, up top.
Yeah, hello.
You know?
Wanda Sykes, the great Wanda Sykes, and W. Kamau Bell. W. Kamau Bell joins us right now from New York City, comedian, host of the critically acclaimed late night talk show, Totally Biased, with W. Kamau on FX. W. Kamau Bell, thanks very much for being here.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me. And Emily, thank you for writing that piece in New Yorker. It's fantastic.
Good exposure. Do you need it? Is the word getting out there?
Yes, I still need it. We have a little tiny show that is like a little engine that maybe it can. You know, we're still plugging away. So we have not yet entered the zeitgeist in a way. And I agree with everyone. Jon Stewart is doing a great job of being Jon Stewart. And I'm not gunning for the title of the next Jon Stewart.
What's your model, Kamau? I mean, are you looking to the old late night guys, Johnny Carson et al? Are you looking at something new? Or is it just what you did in stand-up, now you do here? What?
Well, I mean, it's ironic that, you know, this sort of the way that article that Emily wrote the article is sort of funny to me, because Chris Rock being sort of the sort of the post one end, and then the comedy she's writing about me being included in the other end, and yet I sit as Chris Rock as the executive producer of my show.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yes. Okay.
I've heard that discussion many times.
Well, but is your executive producer dissing you, Kamau?
Yeah, it's funny. I just was like, yeah, he said that to me before. You know, I don't think he is dissing me, but I do think that when you're Chris Rock, first of all, I think there's two things. I think Chris Rock is a big sports fan, and I think therefore he would understand the analogy. You know, I think there's never anybody better than Michael Jordan, and yet all my friends say that LeBron James is great. You know what I'm saying? It's like, it's just your era always seems better to you, I think, is one thing. And two, I think Chris Rock is at a level where he sort of feels like if you're not trying to sell out Madison Square Garden, then you could probably be doing better.
But here's the thing. The guys that he puts up on the pedestal there, George Carlin, Richard Pryor, Cosby, Joan Rivers, gals, you know, they had to aim for the big funny bone because that's what the media was. Now you don't. So what audience do you have in mind, if any, Kamau, when you're doing your routine?
I mean, I always say that the audience I'm thinking about is people who look like me and people who have friends who look like me.
Does that mean black, nerdy, laid-back, friendly people all over the country? What does that mean?
It's funny. I never thought of it. I never used those words to describe myself until I saw people in the press describe me as those.
Sorry. No, you're not a nerd. You're a stud muffin, and you're, like, totally put
there
together.
There we go. But, you know, I think it's, for me, it was literally like when the audience coordinator came in to say, what type of audience do you want? And that's what I said. I said, it was like, you know, if you can find black guys with afros and their friends, I feel like I'm good no matter what else we have in common. You know what I'm saying?
Yes. So
there's a sense of people who, my primary interest in an audience is open-mindedness.
So what about a white guy or gal with a buzz cut? Are they going to laugh at your humor because that may be the audience you visualize, but everybody gets it anyway or not?
Well, no, I mean, I think, you know, the whole thing with the show, and I'm still learning this as I do it, is that I'm trying to entertain the crowd that's in the audience and then hope that the people watching at home are also getting it, you know?
Yeah.
And so I'm only sort of really in the mix of the show concerned with the crowd who's in the room with me. I think that, you know, I had a solo show where I did it's called the W. Kamau Bell Curve, Ending Racism in About an Hour.
Yeah.
And we had a promo where if you brought a friend of a different race, you got in 2-for-1. And I did that because I wanted to make sure
I got a diverse
mixed audience. Because for me, diverse audiences are smarter audiences.
Emily Nussbaum, be our guru here. If a wonderful comic like Kamau aims at the audience in front of him, you know, is comedy still universal enough? If you aim at a niche, you're going to light up the hole or not?
Well, again, as I said before, I don't think that it's there's just a split thing where you aim at everyone or you aim at three people. Like, I think that it's a more complicated continuum than that. I'm really interested that you said that you aim at the audience in the room. I mean, again, I don't know exactly how different talk show hosts see it, like how much they see it as aiming at the camera, how much they see it as aiming at the online audience, at the offline, you know, like at the people right in front of them, at their guests. And I do have to say that on this particular show, there's just a really good feeling of having been invited to a party that has a nice, friendly human vibe. And that's part of why I like the show, is that feeling of the host relating to the audience. And there's a lot of back and forth between you and people in the audience. Like, you seem to notice their reactions. Mm. I think that's pretty difficult, probably, if you're working with an enormous auditorium full of people. But of course, you know, lots of hosts play to the audience. I don't know exactly how that works on different shows in terms of making the show sort of pop on screen as a TV thing. But it is an interesting question. I mean, but the whole preaching to the choir thing is complicated. You know, Chris Rock's statement which mm-hmm. does come from like his, you know, like he has this curmudgeonly take on the world a lot of the time.
Plus, and I see arena just, humor. I mean, I've seen him do gigantic, you know, stadium scale.
But you can't even lump together the people that he's talking about. It's like George Carlin did one kind of thing.
True.
Phyllis Diller is a fantastic performer, but when you read her actual routines, like, was she the funniest woman of the time? Like, that doesn't make any sense when you read the actual routines that she did. Mm. She had enormous charisma, and she was willing to play into an extremely difficult environment for being a physical performer. But the material she did was all about mocking her own ugliness and all of that kind of thing. That was the kind of routine that you could use to appeal to a large audience. It's not the only way that a woman comic can speak, and so I think it's better now.
True. I mean, Kamau, if you're looking for that afroed hipster and the white guy or gal he brought with him, too, for one, and you want to get him first and maybe them.
Or the Asian hipster.
Or the Asian hipster, you name it. I mean, the whole thing. But do you feel like that's working? Are the jokes going to resonate across the whole country, or are we each going to be laughing in our silos here? What do you think?
I mean, I think as a comic, you just want to get – my job is to get the biggest laughs possible with the audience that's in front of me.
Yeah.
And I can't – I mean, this is, you know, certainly this is the way I'm thinking about it. I can't really be worried about the people who I can't see.
But you'd like to have them watch. You'd like to have that audience, and I get.
Yeah, no, certainly, I'd like to have them watch, and I'd like to have the, you know. But I think that if I'm playing for the audiences in front of me, and also I think there's a side of it that I really enjoy is that the kind of audience we have on the show is a very diverse audience. I think Key and Peele has that, and you don't see that on TV all the time.
No, that's true. Yeah,
absolutely.
I mean,
I think that's an important part of it for me is that that America can actually see my audience, and maybe there's somebody at home going, I don't think this is funny, but those people do. Huh, I wonder if there's something going on here I should pay more attention.
Yeah, let me listen again. I mean, maybe I'm carrying a torch for something that's old-fashioned. Certainly, there's a lot of late-night humor that's just so broad and boring, I don't care for it. But you do want – I mean, the idea in part has always been, Kamau, that a great humorist could take us to universal truths and make us see life together, that there was some kind of binding balm in humor. And I guess that's what I'm wondering, Kamau, if that's still working. Let me get it here, Emily. I'll come to you. Kamau.
I'm sorry.
No, I mean, I think it's funny that you would say that. I feel like that's exactly what my show is doing.
Good.
I think that we make a real, real big, I mean, one of the, you know, and I think that, you know, we've had a great time around the office talking about you know, the intersectional progressivism that we use, that Emily talked about in the article. And I was like, yeah, that's what it is. I didn't know that's what the name was, but that's what it is. That we're actually trying to, I think a lot of humor in general has played, when you say played broad, has maybe played to white people.
Yes.
Is what is the definition of broad, because that's the biggest swath of America. It's like 69% of America. So if you want the broadest audience possible, you're talking about white people in general. Whereas my show, it's like we're trying to play to the people who maybe aren't always played to.
Yeah.
And I think there's still universal truth in there. I think that, you know, Richard Pryor was one of the biggest comedians in America talking about growing up in a whorehouse. Most of us didn't grow up in whorehouses. I'm gonna go ahead and say that and stick by that. But there's still universal truth in having a hard childhood or having a childhood that doesn't live up to your expectations.
Amen. Emily, let me get one call. Jim in Nashville. You're on, Jim. Thanks for calling.
Yeah. Hi, Tom. Hi, Emily.
Hi.
Hello.
What do you think, Jim?
I couldn't hear you very well. Hey, I just wanted to weigh in on this whole modern versus, classic comedy thing. I'm 64 years old, so I'm in that very vulnerable generation where nostalgia often seems very attractive. And in many ways it is, but not with new comedy. I find everybody I see and hear that's new is just fresh and wonderful, and I love it all. Far better than going back and seeing, you know, old films. And I grew up with Steve Allen, who, of course, is a, you know, nobody's more of a standard of early comedy, I think.
So bring it on. It sounds fresh to you, Jim, listening in Nashville. I apologize, but I want to hear Emily out on this big point. I appreciate your call. Emily, how about it? What's it do for us that's different or better, or you name it? What's the bottom line on this?
Well, the thing I wanted to say was I thought Kamau hit it on the head when he was talking about, you were talking about does comedy provide a kind of universal balm? And to me, this is, you know, we keep talking about his show and Key and Peele in terms of the Afrocentrism of the shows, which are definitely part of them. But nobody talks about Johnny Carson as a white television creator. Like,
well, we do now, but then.
As a white host in this way, or talking about white culture. And it just becomes difficult because mainstream culture or white culture or male comedy or things like that are just taken as the default setting. And it's not the only thing that's great about niche comedy, but it is one of the things is that it's more welcoming to a wider range. And in that way, you just get more voices heard. And you don't have the assumption that if you can't make white guys laugh, that what you're saying isn't funny.
Kamau, sounds like liberation to me.
Sounds good to me.
Hey, W. Kamau Bell of Totally Biased with W. Kamau Bell on FX. Really terrific of you to join us today, Kamau. Thanks a lot. We'll see you at FX and beyond. Thanks.
Thanks.
Emily Nussbaum with The New Yorker. I'm so glad you picked this up and gave it a good look. Listeners, check her story out at onpointradio.org. There's a link there. Emily, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.